Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, March 19th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
So today on the show, we're listening back to a recording of a live event we did at the historic Temperance House in Newtown as part of Studio 2's Tavern Revolution 250 series. It was a great event.
Great event.
And while most of our events, we talk about bold revolutionaries, foreign alliances, the fight for liberty, for this event, we spoke about something that you rarely hear about. The people who didn't want the revolution, the ones who weren't waving flags for King George, but also weren't willing to sign up for the rebellion, they were the folks in the middle who we call the disaffected. And we sat down with a historian and author who wrote about these folks and has studied the 9 months when the British occupied Philadelphia, beginning in the fall of 1777. And so we're going to listen to that conversation. And it was very interesting. I remember that. I'm looking forward to hearing back.
Totally. I thought it was a great conversation.
Yeah.
There was a quote that was used actually in the Ken Burns doc about the American Revolution. And the quote was, "Philadelphia is the asylum of the disaffected."
Yeah, so many people were here.
So a lot of people who were caught in the middle were in this region for various reasons, mm-hmm. some religious reasons, some just they were merchants and they wanted to keep, you know, relations with both sides. So Philadelphia is thought of now as like, you know, the cauldron of rebellion, but it wasn't totally
that
way.
It
wasn't totally that way. So we're going to bring you that conversation for the bulk of the show today.
Yes.
We also, because it's Thursday, are going to bring you a DJ of the day at the end of the hour. As you likely know, every Thursday we end the show with a song picked by one of you on the topic of that day's show. And you email your submission to epkevin@studio2@whyy.org, and he picks the winner and we shout you out at the end of the show. And so I guess the theme today is
like, I don't care, I don't want to do it, I'm in the middle, I don't want to
neutrality
fight. Yeah, I want to survive the crazy, whatever kind of theme you think fits with the folks who are just in the middle. They just wanted to get through it. Okay.
Yes.
And again, email.
I will survive. Yeah.
Email. I know. I have all kinds of songs.
There's a lot of good songs for this one.
This is a great
it's a rich
topic.
Yeah.
Studio2@whyy.org. And again, you have to send it in by 12:30. And so we still have our trio of news
stories. Still got our trio.
Today.
Let's start it off. A pair of Philadelphia landlords sued city council to delay a vote on a pair of bills meant to protect renters. And as a result of that lawsuit, there's been an emergency settlement and the vote on this legislative package has indeed been postponed. We don't know when it's going to happen at this point. So if you haven't been following, this is the latest development in what has become a surprisingly nasty legislative fight. Here's the backstory. This is a pair of bills. The most controversial thing it would do is that it would expand a provision that limits Philadelphia landlords' ability to stop renting to a current tenant. Essentially, it would make it so landlords would have to have, quote, good cause or a reason to terminate or not renew a lease. Backers of that provision say it protects tenants from retaliation or bad faith slumlords. The city's main landlord group says this creates a pathway for problem tenants to avoid consequences. Now, when this bill passed out of committee, some landlords were so pissed they started yelling at city council on the spot. It was a bit of a chaotic scene. You can hear a little bit of it in this clip. Go ahead and roll it. And there's people gesticulating and pointing and screaming at the city council members. It was a pretty wild scene. And then that was followed up by this lawsuit that basically says some aspects of these bills were worked out behind closed doors in violation of Sunshine Act rules. And so as a result, the package now has to head back to committee where it could presumably pass again, but they just have to go through the process at least one more time.
Yeah, this issue has been blowing up my personal timeline. Yeah. Former Fox 29 sports anchor Bill Vargas was one of the guys in the video, and he went viral. He was recently profiled by the Philadelphia Tribune, and he and other small landlords, they have argued that the bill would have caused major red tape for them being able to keep their rental license. And, you know, because it would require that L&I come in and do inspections before you could get your rental license, but L&I doesn't have the manpower to really do it. And so they argued that it would put a lot of small landlords out of business. And a lot of folks feel like that wasn't fair, that a lot of these landlords are not slumlords. And so there's been this push-pull, and people feel really strongly about this. And unfortunately, it got kind of nasty and personal.
Yes.
But hopefully with this settlement and things sort of, you know, coming into the light where there's going to be more public hearings, things will, the temperature will be brought down.
Yeah, this fight is about some specific bills here in Philadelphia, yeah. but it's clearly become about something larger.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
the sort
for
of
sure.
tug and pull between the landlord class and the renter class. Mm-hmm. And so that's why these videos have been circulating all over online. You know, it's it's about this debate, but it's clearly now about something
and
else.
A lot of landlords in Philly are like small landlords.
Sure.
They're not like these big rich corporations. So there's the push pull there.
And a lot of renters are very vulnerable in Philadelphia
exactly.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Story number two, Cherry.
Yes. New Jersey lawmakers have introduced a bill that would ban surveillance pricing. And if you've never heard of it, surveillance pricing happens when retailers, usually grocery stores, change the prices of items depending on the customer. And grocery stores allegedly use customer personal data like who the person is, where they live, age, time of day, etc., all usually taken from online shopping information, and they use it to adjust the prices in your shopping cart online and sometimes on digital price tags in grocery stores. For example, they could charge someone a higher price than someone they're trying to woo into the store to be a first-time shopper, for example. And the bill is called the Fair Price Protection Act. It would prohibit companies from using personal data to set individual prices. New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill has been among the lawmakers who criticize surveillance pricing. But critics say it would make it harder to give discounts to some folks.
Yeah, it's an interesting little debate. It sounds like from what at least the Trade Association New Jersey says, that in that state, there's not been surveillance pricing used at physical brick and mortar stores.
Mm-hmm.
There is evidence of online shopping companies using it, like Instacart.
Yeah,
that was the main one. There seems to be two potential issues here. One is just the collection of the data itself, the surveillance part.
Yeah, that part scares people. Yeah.
Doesn't sound like this bill or anything that's being proposed in New Jersey would do much of anything about that. The second part is how it's being used to set prices for individuals. And for that, I am curious if someone has actually done the work to see, does it make prices on the whole higher or lower? Because it could be used to move the price in either direction, up or down, based on what it's collected about you.
I think this bill just tries to flatten the price and say it's the same for everybody, not depending on, you know, where you live or who they think you are or how much money they think you have. But I think some more work needs to be done on all of this because, you know, at the end of the day, it just seems like this data is being used in a very manipulative way. And we also talked about how people were getting kind of price gouged at some of the discount
right.
stores. You'd be at the aisle at, say, one price, and then they charge you a higher price, you know, at the checkout.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of pricing
That's a totally different issue.
But there's a lot of issues with pricing that are happening. And legislators, I think, are just trying to figure out how to do it. But this surveillance pricing is fairly new. I hadn't really heard of it. But it is kind of like disconcerting that my data can be used against me and possibly used to charge me
or
more
could be used
or
for
less.
You. Or could
or
be
less.
Used for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Story number three.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is absolutely loving a tennis ball collecting robot that was created by some Philadelphia area high school students. Let's run this video. Look at that thing go.
It is amazing.
It's amazing. So
it's amazing.
If you're listening on the radio, here's what's happening. There's a robot zooming around a room, gobbling up tennis balls and rapidly flinging them into a basket quite accurately. But somehow the robot, which is moving at all times, knows exactly how far away it is from the collection basket. So I guess there are some sensors involved. That wondrous machine was created by Team 341,
Yay.
A robotics club based at Wissahickon High School in Ambler. The robot is called Miss Daisy. And if you look at the comments under this viral video, there's a lot of people being like, whoa, how does that thing work? And like, I build robots and this is legitimately impressive. So it sounds like these teenagers have created a pretty remarkable machine. Yeah,
best comment I saw called this invention the Steph Curry of whatever this is. and it was definitely jaw-dropping.
Dropping buckets, man.
It was definitely jaw-dropping because the average person is going to miss those tennis ball shots. They're going to miss it.
Oh, yeah.
And this bot is spinning and whipping and moving and only had like two misfires.
Yes.
And that was barely a misfire because the ball just kind of bounced.
It's amazing.
So this is what I call excellent programming. Kudos to the kids.
And by the way, Team 341, I looked this up. They entered this into a competition at Hapro Horsham High School, and I think they won, which they absolutely should have won.
Absolutely.
And if I'm a tennis instructor, I'm trying to get my hands on one of these.
Yeah.
You can clean up the court in like 2 seconds.
It's really cool. And by the way, I was so impressed that it was a lot of girls on this team too. So it was a very like collaborative effort. I loved it.
Shout out Team 341.
Yes.
Officially, our minds better than Steph Curry, but not better than the rest of the show, which is still coming up.
We'll be right back.
On Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
Welcome back to Studio 2 from Ye Olde WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I am Cherry Gregg. If you were alive during the American Revolution, which side would you have been on? Would you have been a patriot, a loyalist to the crown, or maybe somewhere in between?
As part of our America at 250 Tavern Tour series, today we're taking a closer look at those people in the middle, a group often overlooked when telling the story of America's founding.
Rider University historian and professor Aaron Sullivan documented this group in his book, The Disaffected. It's all about how these people fared when the British Army took over Philadelphia in the fall of 1777.
We recently sat down with Aaron at the Temperance House in Newtown, Bucks County, in front of a live audience. And we started the conversation by asking him to take us back in time, after the war started, but before the British marched into Philadelphia.
So we're going back 250 years. We're in the middle of a revolutionary war. And here in the American colonies, a civil war, brother against brother, American against American. I think it's often we visualize that as the Patriots versus the British, these two sides. And sometimes we remember the Loyalists, those Americans who sided with the British. But the group we tend to overlook the most are the ones who didn't take a side at all, the people who really saw this war not as a natural rebellion to be crushed or as this glorious cause to be won, but as this dangerous tragedy they had to somehow survive. You had a whole lot of people who were caught in the middle, who were undecided, who were disaffected. In Pennsylvania specifically, it's probably safe to say that's the plurality. That's the most common stance, is the how can we get through this with keeping my family intact, my business intact, my farm intact as the higher priority than independence or empire.
So Philadelphia is the biggest city in the colonies. It's a huge commercial powerhouse. Why isn't this the place where patriotic sentiment is bubbling the most? Why is it Boston and New England where it seems like the revolution initially takes hold?
So Pennsylvania is this incredibly fractured colony. William Penn founds this place as a refuge for Quakers, but also for everybody. He goes throughout Europe looking for disenfranchised groups and says, come here. You know, you won't have to subscribe to a particular religion. You don't even have to all speak the same language. We get all these sort of little groups throughout Pennsylvania doing their own thing, culturally and politically. So it's then really hard to get all those people together for anything, whether it's a rebellion or an attempt to stay loyal to the empire. They're not used to working closely together for a common cause. They just want to live their lives. And when the revolution comes along, they just want to live their lives.
And by contrast, New England, different situation, a much more sort of unified culturally and religiously, right?
Yeah, they were much more a uniform block in the way they lived lives. And so once they decided as a group, we're in this thing for independence and self-determination, they sort of all went along with that.
Yeah. And so how did people on either side of this view the folks in the middle? You have the revolutionaries, the people who were for independence and were willing to take on the British. how did they feel about them? And then how did the loyalists feel about them?
Well, both sides tended to look at the disaffected or people in the middle as essentially enemies. It was very much a, if you're not for us, you're against us kind of thing. There are some differences, though. The British expected all Americans to sort of fall in line, to remain loyal to the king, and if they didn't, then they looked at that as a form of treason. But the revolutionaries really cared about it in a different way because of their political structure. The patriots said, this is going to be a nation founded, legitimated by the will of the people. And that was a radical idea. That was a new idea. That was an important idea to them. But if you say that, if you say that your government is legitimated by the will of the people, then the people had better stand up and say they support you and your new government. And if they don't, that gets very uncomfortable for you as a patriot. So there's a lot of pressure on you to make them stand up and say, yes, we the people support this new nation. And the revolutionaries sometimes, maybe even often, went a little far in coercing that sort of consent out of people, making them stand up and say, we support this revolution.
Yeah, I'd love you to give some of the details from your book about how that coercion was carried out, because there was a revolutionary government in Pennsylvania, and it seems like the way that they went after people who they considered to be loyalists or just not sufficiently loyal wasn't exactly in line with the ideals that they were professing to fight for.
Yeah, Pennsylvania had arguably the most radical revolutionary government of any colonies. They have very limited resources. They have very limited tools. You've got to make the most of what you do, and often that leads to intimidation. And they did put a tremendous amount of pressure on the people to support them. Probably the climax of that comes in 1777. As the British are approaching Philadelphia to occupy it, the revolutionaries in Pennsylvania will pass what's called the Test Act. And this is a law which mandates an oath of allegiance to Pennsylvania as an independent state, and mandates that you renounce your allegiance to King George. And these oaths aren't optional. They are legally mandatory. And if you refuse to swear those oaths, you lose a host of rights. You can't vote anymore. You can't run for office. You can't sue people in the courts. You can't serve on juries. You can't own guns anymore. You can't inherit real estate anymore. And ultimately, if you persist in not taking this oath of allegiance, they can imprison you and banish you altogether from the state.
And they do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they do.
Yeah.
The exiles, they went on a long trip. Yeah. First, they had to go west quite a ways because they had to get around the invading British army. So they're going to go through what's now Harrisburg and eventually south through a little bit of Maryland and down into Virginia. And that's where they'll spend the bulk of their exile. They're not in prison cells, but they are under guard. One of them will try to run away, and he'll successfully escape. That just makes everything worse for the rest of them. And two of them will die in exile. They will never make it back home again. They'll never get a day in court. They'll never get an apology. They'll never get any money back. But they will eventually be very awkwardly released.
Yeah. The folks who declined to declare their loyalty, give us some sense of who they were and why they would have made that decision. The first thought I think a lot of people have is the Quakers. That's maybe a religious, philosophical objection, but they're not alone. And like you said, Pennsylvania is really culturally and religiously diverse. So give us some sense of the groups of people who would have said no to that and why they would have said no.
Sure. So there are the Quakers. There are people who are pacifists. They have moral objections to this sort of violence. There are people, especially in Philadelphia, as we said, it's this major trade port. Philadelphia's putting out more tonnage of grain and beef than any other city in America. They are closely tied to this transatlantic trade network administered by the British Empire. So there's an economic incentive just to try to ride this thing out and make your money that way.
So were they afraid that they would declare their loyalty, the British would win, and then their trade interests would be hurt in subsequent years because of that? Because if you're trying to protect your business right then, it might be a good idea to say yes to the authority of the day. But they're what they're thinking on a longer horizon?
Yeah, I mean, there is always the temptation to say, I support whoever's in charge.
Yeah.
But the danger is who's in charge might change.
Right.
And again, Philadelphia is a great example of this. Philadelphia is 1 year the capital of a British colony. It is the next year the de facto capital of the United States in rebellion against the British Empire. And then the next year it is the headquarters of the British Army in America.
Right. Yeah.
And then the next year it's back to being the capital of the United States. So that so declaration, which is good for you this year, might be treason next year.
And so maybe best not to sign anything. Outside of the Quakers and then the folks who were looking out for their economic interests, are there any other important groups to highlight here, whether in Philadelphia or elsewhere in Pennsylvania?
I think actually the most important thing is to recognize how widespread that disaffection was and how it wasn't necessarily sort of tied to this identity.
Yeah.
I think it's really easy for us to look back and say, oh, it's the American Revolution. This is the creation of the United States. It's the creation of the first really successful democratic republic on a large scale. How could you not be involved in this? How could you not pick a side? But if we try to really put ourselves there, we're talking about your livelihood, maybe your life, the life of your children is going to be on the line. I think we can see it's very much human nature to be caught in the middle.
And what stood out to me, you talked about the militia for Pennsylvania. Many people were involved, but when it came time to actually fight and they called out the troops, a lot of folks didn't show up. Can you talk us through that, like this creation of this militia and why so many people just didn't want to get involved in the actual war?
Yeah, the militia is a great lens to see disaffection in Pennsylvania specifically. So Pennsylvania did not have this universal mandatory militia tradition that New England did. They had temporary militias along the way for emergencies, but not this constant mandatory system. So when they create one in the 1770s, it's closely identified with the revolution. Serving in the militia is a way to say, I support the revolution. But they don't make it optional. They make it mandatory. So you have to serve in the militia. And if you don't, the fines for refusing to do so are incredibly steep. If you're just like a common laborer, you might spend a third of your annual income just paying that fine for not serving. So there's immense pressure. And as a result, a lot of people sign up. They fill the militia roles for people who are willing to serve. And it seems like if you just froze it right there, said, oh, look how much support the revolution has in Pennsylvania. But then we get to 1777, and the British invasion begins. And suddenly, the Patriots can't enforce these fines anymore. They can't make you serve if you don't want to. And this is when the militia begins to fall apart. So when General Howe and the British Army invade, Washington has promised 4,000 militiamen. He gets 2,000. That's not great. But that number starts to go down real fast. By the Battle of Brandywine, he's at 1,200. Then he's just down to the hundreds. And by February of 78, he's down to 60. 60 militiamen fit to serve in the field because people don't turn out. But crucially, those people, they don't want to be in the militia. They don't go to Philadelphia to work for the British either. The British Army comes in with 5,000 uniforms for Pennsylvanians, saying we're going to make this army of loyalists and they're going to help us take over. But General Howe, try as he might, and he really, really tries, he cannot make an army of loyalist Pennsylvanians because they don't want to fight for him either. They just want to be left alone.
I want to talk about what it was like as we get to a place where the British are about to occupy Philadelphia. What was happening in the weeks prior to that and that got to a place where Philadelphia was essentially under siege?
So the British come down to Pennsylvania. At this point, they've already occupied New York, so that city has fallen. And Philadelphia is their next target. It's the seat of the Continental Congress, the de facto capital of the revolution. It makes sense that this is a city that they want to take. The British will come in and take the city. People who are strongly tied to the Patriot cause will flee. They don't want to be arrested and persecuted by the British. But most people stay. They say, my priority is to take care of my home, my family, my business. The political winds are shifting, but I'm going to try to ride this thing out.
When they get to Philadelphia, how does the reception compare to what they received when they marched into New York?
On the one hand, there was a much bigger battle for New York than there was in Philadelphia. They take Philadelphia without actually firing a shot here in the city. They just managed to march in. On the other hand, the loyalists in New York were fairly celebratory about the arrival of the British Army. The arrival of the British Army in Philadelphia was a remarkably quiet affair. There are certainly some loyalists who come out and are very excited, but if you look at the journals of the time, there's also a lot of silence. The army's marching through the street. People are there. They're watching it, but they're just quietly watching this army come in.
Yeah. And they were expecting something different, or was that what they, you think the British expected, that people would not be happy?
I think the British expected to be greeted as liberators. General Howe had come to Pennsylvania kind of with the promise that there's lots of loyalism in that state. They will greet you as liberators and be happy to sign on to fight for your cause. And that's not what he found when he got here.
And that was Aaron Sullivan, a historian, professor at Rider University, and the author of The Disaffected, Britain's Occupation of Philadelphia During the American Revolution.
In just a moment, we'll be back with more about what life was like for Philadelphians living under occupation, and how assuming that women were politically neutral became a crucial misstep for the revolutionaries trying to win the city back. That's all coming up after the break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The bulk of our show today is based on an event we hosted recently at the Temperance House in Newtown, Bucks County. It was part of our coverage this year of the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence.
Today, we're looking at the American Revolution through the eyes of the people at the time who decided to stay neutral. Let's pick up our conversation with Aaron Sullivan, historian and professor at Rider University, who takes us to the moment when the British marched into Philadelphia and kicked off a 9-month occupation of the nation's capital.
So life is rough throughout the occupation. It is especially hard at the beginning. The revolutionaries wanted the city back. They tried to take it back. We got the Battle of Germantown. Washington's defeated there. His next attempt is, well, maybe we can starve them out. If we cut off all supplies to Philadelphia, they can't feed the army. They'll have to leave. General Washington is out in the countryside trying to stop all trade with the city, trying to keep food from arriving. You have these patrols, often mounted patrols, that are on the road doing everything they can to intercept people who are bringing food to the city. And so for those initial months, things were really lean. Prices were very high if you could find food to buy at all. The British Army notably kept its own rations for itself. It did not distribute them to the people in the city. They were left very much on their own. So you were looking for someone who would like be willing to smuggle their way through Patriot lines to bring you a pound of butter or a dozen eggs or something, and you would pay a very high price for that.
Yeah, I was actually very surprised to hear that George Washington resorted to those tactics. But I want to talk about women and how women specifically were used to help smuggle items in and out of the city during this occupation, and how George Washington tried to educate his troops to fight against that. Could you talk about the role of women in bringing goods in and out the city?
Absolutely. So at least early on, it's safe to say the majority of smuggled goods that got into the city came with women, not with men. And this was a way women were able to take advantage of the fact that they were seen as apolitical by most men. They just assumed that women could not have strong political opinions. And if you can't have strong political opinions, you can't really be a traitor, can you? So women would go along the road and they would take all these goods and they would head to the city. And they would sometimes be intercepted, but they would not be treated as traitors. They would be treated as confused, and often they'd be just sent home with their own goods.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are repeated incidents where these women will come along the road and they'll meet these young militiamen who are on their horses, and they're meeting these young women, and they get to talking, and the men want to take care of them, and they say, it's dangerous out here, there's a war zone, let me give you an escort. And they would escort these women to British lines. And Washington recognized this, and he was just furious, and he was constantly writing letters saying, no, you have to stop these women. He was trying to keep women out of the camp because they were bringing in goods and trading with the men there. So he at least recognized, no, these women are a significant factor in breaking my embargo, but he really struggled to get men to recognize it.
And before the British leave, I got to ask about one population of people, African Americans, because there were free people, there were enslaved people, and which side did they choose in the middle of this revolution? Were many of them still disaffected and unclear about loyalties as well?
So when we're looking at enslaved people, I mean, they're one of the hardest populations to read. So we're often looking at, like, what did they do? Because people didn't write down what they said. They didn't pay enough attention. But we can look at, what did they do? Where did they move to? And we know a lot of them moved to the occupied city while the British was here because Britain had unofficially decided at that point, the enslaved people owned by patriot masters who come to our lines, we're going to set them free. We're not returning them back to slavery. They'll make that official policy later, but it was already unofficial when the occupation began. So you get enslaved people who run to the city and they find freedom, and that's wonderful. But they'll also notice, well, what about the slaves owned by all these loyalists? The British will never set them free. There are still slave auctions in Philadelphia during the occupation. That's very uncomfortable for them. The people who are now free in Philadelphia are going to be scrounging for jobs. This time where there's very little food, everything is expensive. They are at the bottom of the latter, it's very hard for them. And a number of them, when the occupation ends and Britain leaves Philadelphia, they will not go with the British Army back to New York. They will say, you know, thank you for getting me out of slavery, but I don't really trust you guys anymore. I think I'm better off on my own. So they're not necessarily loyal to the empire now just because they're free. They don't trust them. They don't trust the revolutionaries. They also just want to live their lives with freedom.
And the other part that I was so fascinated by was how soldiers on both sides lived with people who were disaffected, and they moved in with them, sometimes under force. Sometimes the people were held captive, locked in rooms. Can you give us some examples of both positive interactions and maybe a negative interaction where folks who were loyalist or part of the revolution took over someone's house? And you're disaffected. You're not trying to be in it, but they're living there with you.
Yeah, so the British Army comes into Philadelphia. Before the British Army arrives, Philadelphia has a population around 30,000, roughly. Now, about 10,000 of those people are going to flee, but a number of them will come back over the course of the occupation. The British Army is another 15,000 or so people on top of that. So it's a very crowded city, and they've got to find a place to put these soldiers. They expected to be greeted as liberators, to be welcomed into people's homes. That does not happen. So you get a lot of elite British officers who thought they would have nice, cozy houses. They'd be welcomed in. And for the first few months, they're like living in ships in the harbor or in barracks. They hate this. So they will begin to force their way into people's houses. You now have to have this officer living with you. And that could have some benefits. It usually had a lot of drawbacks. The officer would take over whatever space he wanted, maybe the best bedroom, maybe some parlors, maybe the kitchen, maybe the outhouses. They were noted for partying late at night, making a lot of noise. They would drink. They would have what they would call loose women over, which, you know, if you're an elite Quaker in the city, this is very alarming to you. It's happening under your roof. On the other hand, if you got really lucky, you might get a reasonably nice, gentlemanly officer in your house. And if he was there in your house, that was some protection against the regular soldiers of the British Army, who were also inclined to take stuff they wanted and to break things and to make off with your property. But if you had an officer there in the house, they probably wouldn't do that because they were afraid of him. So there are stories of families that appreciated having an officer. I mean, they would rather not live in an occupied city at all.
And there were relationships happening. You know, I always perked up. I was like, ooh, this is a little drama, a little gossip going on. Because there were relationships happening between some of these soldiers, between some of the people who lived in the community. Life was still happening under occupation.
Yeah, I mean, this is going on for 9 months. And there are a number of interesting relationships going in a whole bunch of different ways. You find young servant women in Philadelphia who have a chance to marry a soldier now that they would never have had a chance to do before, and they will do so, and they'll go with the British Army. On the other hand, you also have a bunch of British officers and British soldiers, and especially Hessian soldiers, who get here and they meet a nice lady in Philadelphia and say, Pennsylvania seems like an awfully nice place. And when the British Army leaves, they quietly sneak off with the lady they met and they start living in Pennsylvania. And then you've got the elites of Philadelphia, and this is a whole new thing for them, right? They were here in this colony. It's the biggest city in the colonies, but it's still a colony. They've always been looked down on by the metropolis back across the Atlantic. But now, why, my God, there are knights here. There are peers of the realm in Philadelphia as part of the army. They're sitting side by side with them and having tea and going to dances. It was a very exciting moment if you were willing to sit down with these people.
Okay, so on one hand, you have the Americans trying to restrict the food supply in the city, terrorizing people in the countryside, controlling the river for a while. And then on the other hand, you have the British who are in another way terrorizing some people, taking their property, maybe not always acting properly. So in the battle for hearts and minds, is anyone winning here over these 9 months, or is it kind of a draw?
Early on, it depends on where you're at. So for the bulk of the occupation, if you're inside the city, you are probably developing a lower and lower opinion of the British, just because they're doing damage, they're in people's houses, there's a lot of crime, there's a lot of theft, there's a lot of rape. It is alienating to be under military occupation. That tends to always be the case. If you're in the countryside, outside the city, there is, if anything, a movement toward liking the British a little bit more, or at least liking the revolutionaries less.
Resenting the Patriots, yeah.
It is the Patriots who are taking your stuff, who are threatening you if you continue your trade with the city. The British are buying your stuff for gold and silver currency, which is hard to come by. They start to seem like maybe they're the good guys in there. Now, at the end of the occupation, it is unquestionably a disaster for the British in terms of hearts and minds, because the British, they came, they seemed like they were setting up to take over Pennsylvania, and a number of people said, okay, I see which way the wind is blowing. The British have won every battle here in Pennsylvania. I'm signing on with them. And then suddenly the British in the summer of 78 say, actually, we're leaving. They weren't driven out. There's no battle. They just choose. Philadelphia will not be our priority in this war. We are withdrawing from the city.
Yeah. One thing that's a little hard to wrap your mind around is that there's a war and there's a rebellion, I should say, and that the force putting down the rebellion occupies the rebels' capital city for months, but that doesn't decide the war, and then they just leave. So why wasn't it decisive? And then why did they say, okay, we're done?
So this is both a great strength and a weakness of the revolution. It is decentralized. So you look at Britain, right? All power clearly flows up through Parliament and the King. London is where it's at. You take London, you've pretty much beaten Britain. America has no city like that. Power is spread out amongst all the colonies and then the states. Congress is significant, but it's not necessarily vital in and of itself. So the British will capture Philadelphia, they'll capture New York, they'll capture Boston, they'll capture Providence, they'll capture
like
Charleston.
Yeah.
All of the big cities in America will fall to the British Army, but they cannot kill this thing. They cannot cut heads off fast enough to stop it. So just capturing Philadelphia, it's not going to do the job. The revolution will continue.
But there was some military strategy behind trying to occupy Philadelphia. And at that point, they'd occupied other cities, seeing that it hadn't ended the revolution. So why did they think somehow Philadelphia would be, if not decisive, at least meaningful?
So there is, on one hand, there's the desire to create this loyalist army. Again, they thought they could do that in Pennsylvania. Turns out they couldn't. But the other reason was, since Philadelphia was the de facto capital, it's where Congress was, General William Howe thought Washington will have to fight to defend it.
Trying to draw him into a decisive battle. Yeah.
Washington was not necessarily great at winning battles, but he was very good at getting away. He did this in New York over and over again. He kept getting away.
And Howe thought, he's a survivor.
Right.
He's a survivor.
Howe thought, if I go for Philadelphia, he will have to stand and fight me. And he does. At the Battle of Brandywine, they have one of the largest battles of the entire Revolution. Howe against Washington, army against army, and the British will win. And Washington, kind of by the skin of his teeth, will again escape. And the army will continue. As for why the British leave, so this is a crucial moment in the Revolution. In 77, when the British take over Philadelphia, they are dominating. They've taken New York. They've now taken the American capital. They've won almost every major battle. Everything is on their side. By the summer of 78, they've lost a major battle in Saratoga. And more importantly, they're at war or on the verge of war with France, their biggest enemy. And really, from that moment on, the American Revolution in America is a sideshow. The British will say, we are at war with France on a global scale. The Americas are just one theater of that, and not even the most important theater. And they will very quickly give up on ever reclaiming New England or the Middle Colonies and say, maybe we can slice off the Southern colonies and keep them. But it's hard for us as Americans to recognize how quickly we cease to be important in the British War, once France is involved.
And so now the British are gone. Does the revolutionary, the government, do they relax? Do they then put folks in jail who were loyalists? What happens in the aftermath?
So in the immediate aftermath, there is this desire for vengeance on behalf of the Patriots. They say, you betrayed us, you worked with the British in the city, you traded with them, you supported them, we want blood. You're all traitors to the United States. But it doesn't last long. There's a real shift toward leniency and forgiveness and unity. And I think it says something really important about what the Revolution had become. When this war started, they were the agents of change. They were in rebellion. They were creating a new nation. They desperately needed your support. They needed you to stand up and say, we want change, and we are willing to pay for it. We're willing to bleed and die for it. By the time the British leave, and it's pretty clear they're not coming back in force, the revolutionaries begin to feel like, you know what? We are the established power now. No one else is here. We are the status quo. And if you are the established power, you don't necessarily need everyone to stand up and applaud you the same way. You just need them to get on with your lives, you know, pay your taxes or do your jobs. And so there's this move from demanding consent and support to wanting unity and peace.
So they're not going back with the loyalty oaths, flapping them in people's face, saying sign, sign, sign. That's gone.
No. They will talk about treason, and treason is a capital offense, and unquestionably hundreds, thousands of Philadelphians engaged in what was unquestionably treason, working with the British. They will execute two of them, and then that's it. So this call for blood, there are still some radicals who will stick with it for a long time, but most people are, you know, let's just get on with it. We can all live together now.
I was wondering, you did a great job telling the story of Elizabeth and Henry Drinker, and they were a prominent family. They were an example of a disaffected family. If you could briefly tell their story.
So the Drinkers are this great family in Philadelphia. They're Quakers. Henry Drinker, the husband, is a merchant. He's very successful. His wife is Elizabeth. She writes an amazing diary. If you ever want to read a diary from the Revolution, you can't do better than Elizabeth Drinker. But they're Quakers. They're pacifists. They're trying really hard not to be involved in this war. They won't serve in the militia. They don't want to pay fines that might support the army. They don't want to even use the new money that's being printed to support the war. And they're going to suffer for this in a host of ways. The biggest one is that Henry Drinker will be arrested in September of 77. And he will be banished from the state because he will not take that loyalty oath. He ends up down in Virginia for a number of months as a prisoner, and his wife, Elizabeth, and their children are sort of on their own, even as Philadelphia gets taken over by the British Army, becomes the seat of war. An officer forces himself into Elizabeth's house and is going to live with her for the months of the occupation. It's a really hard time, but she makes it through. She actually makes friends with this officer. He turns out to be one of the good ones. And then they live together in relative peace. She's writing letters to her husband down in Virginia. They're amazing letters. She can't say anything too much about the war. She can't complain too much. She knows everything's being censored. Not just censored, but repeatedly censored, right? The British will read it when it leaves the city. The Revolutionary Army will read it when it leaves the city. And then the people who are keeping Henry prisoner will read it again before it gets to him. So there are these very sanitized letters. but also really affectionate letters. You can tell these people loved each other a lot and missed each other desperately. Eventually, Henry will make it back home before the occupation ends. The Continental Congress and the revolutionary government of Pennsylvania will realize that they banished this man without trial, and the evidence against him was forged and no good. They'll point fingers at each other for several months saying, this is all your fault. But eventually they decide we should just let him go. And they do. He makes it back home, and they're reunited near the very end of the occupation.
Why do you think it's important for us today to remember these people, the disaffected? Does it say something about how we view ourselves, our own country? Does it help us understand other conflicts elsewhere and how people are navigating those? Why do you think this story is important to tell?
I think it's important because we often look back on the American Revolution as our most heroic struggle. It's easy for us to see good guys and bad guys there. And it is really the disaffected who help us recognize that this was a war. Like, things were destroyed, things were burned down, people died, sometimes died badly. They were the ones who recognized this is a tragedy. I think that helps us recognize that human tendency to look for the middle, to try to avoid conflict, and that's going to exist throughout history. If we look at a more modern example, I think it's safe to say America is pretty politically divided today. And those who are politically engaged, we feel very strongly about it. It seems like the stakes are very high. How could people not be involved in this? But if we look at recent American elections, presidential elections, in almost every case, the plurality of eligible voters don't vote for either candidate.
Yeah.
Right? They are disaffected. And that can be for a host of reasons. But my point here is that even today, when the stakes are just, will you get up and go to the polls and vote, a huge percentage of our population cannot pick a side, does not get involved. In the revolution, getting involved doesn't mean going to vote. It means you might be shot.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think it's very understandable. A lot of people said, no, my home, my family, my business, this is what I care about. Politics will do what they may.
Yeah, and that was Aaron Sullivan, a historian professor at Rider University and the author of The Disaffected, Britain's Occupation of Philadelphia During the American Revolution.
Great conversation. Fascinating event.
How'd you thinking?
Makes you wonder, would you be a loyalist? Would you be a patriot? Would you be disaffected? I mean, how do you come down on that, Cherry Gregg?
Well, you know, I think about what he told us about what African Americans were doing at the time, and I would probably be one of the people smuggling the food. Or smuggling the goods.
You'd be smuggling?
And then, as a woman, yes. And
yeah.
Then I would try to figure out a way to get out of there.
And
move on to Canada or go somewhere else, you know, a more freer part of the states as they were being developed. But yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder, where would you be on the line?
I kind of felt myself pulled in the direction of the disaffected.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe this is my self-doubt creeping to the surface, but it's hard to imagine myself taking a heroic stand either way. I just imagine I would try to put my head down, you know?
And it makes you wonder, like, what right now would get you to want to take up arms?
Totally.
And just give up your whole life, unroot your entire family and go to a war. Like, a lot of people wouldn't want to do that. And you
Absolutely.
Think about what's happening across the world. There's probably a lot of people who are kind of in the middle like this.
So many.
Yeah.
In every conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So for more of our Tavern Tour series, you can catch up on past events we taped in locations across the region, including Princeton, Lafayette Hill, and Old City. And stay tuned. We're going to have more conversations about America's founding. Those events on the horizon will be listed at whyy.org/events.
Yes. And speaking of our Tavern Tour series, we have an event tonight at the Barnesboro Inn in Sewell, New Jersey. It is sold out. I've heard it is sold out.
Dang.
But tonight we'll be talking about the Hessians. That's the German auxiliary troops hired by the British. We'll explore the complex and often misunderstood story of these troops. Their presence shaped not only the fighting in the region, but also life across New Jersey during the Revolutionary War.
And by the way, after this Tavern Tour is over, we're going to resume our Studio 2 On the Road series.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be going all over the region, having conversations about all sorts of topics, not just the American Revolution, probably not the revolution at all. And if you have any suggestions about a place we should go,
mm-hmm.
or like a topic we should cover, or maybe a venue that you own,
yeah.
Studio 2 at whyy.org. Send those recommendations episodes. And like I said, we're going to be resuming our typical On the Road series after the summer.
Yeah, for sure. And people are like, come to Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Come here. Totally. All right. Email us.
We'd love
Let
to
us
go.
Know.
Yeah. I love Cherry Hill.
I do too. So, by the way, it is now time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. When you started out with nothing and you found it, you're a selfish man.
So, by popular demand, that is Stuck in the Middle with You by Steeler's Wheel from 1972. That song was produced by the legendary songwriting duo Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. They are the brains behind more than 70 chart hits, including Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Stand By Me, and Is That All There Is?
Yeah, and by the way, I thought it sounded familiar because that song was also famously revived by Quentin Tarantino in a torture scene in his 1992 debut movie, Reservoir Dogs. I'm a huge Tarantino fan, so
that
was like,
dark
I heard that.
Factoid.
I
Jesus.
Know, but I remembered it. Okay. thank you to Mindy M. from Philly, David H. from Galloway, and Kevin C. from Medford for choosing that song and being our DJs of the day. We appreciate you.
And we appreciate our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, the Mid-Atlantic, I'm Avi Wolfman.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks so much for joining us today.